Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future. Living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow line dance song.
Hey, Sangai Nation, welcome to the show on another Friday afternoon. Sangai with you as normal. Good son Andrew Michelson is on assignment today. He won't be joining us, but let me get into some show notes before we jump to our guest today. If you are looking for some wrestling tonight, WCWO at the Outlaw Arena in Indianapolis, Indiana. SOS in our neck of the woods in Tacoma, Washington tonight. CCW in Kissimmee, Florida. And 907 in Anchorage, Alaska tonight. Tomorrow night, Supreme Wrestling in Madison, Indiana. Generation Next in Jeffersonville, Indiana. MPW in Omaha, Nebraska. PPW in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee. 907 back tomorrow night in Anchorage, Alaska. And EWA happening in Frankfort, Kentucky. Without any further ado, I want to welcome our guest to the show. He is an icon and a legend when it comes to independent professional wrestling. King Kalua, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, no problem. You really are reaching all over the country, so I'm really impressed with how much indie wrestling there really is in this great country. So, hey, maybe I'll get booked in Alaska. I don't know.
I can point you towards the right people.
Man, I'm gonna, as long as I don't have to pay a booking fee, I'm good.
There we go. Well, since today happens to be your first time with us, surprisingly enough, I want to start you out with our traditional first-timer question. How did you get into this crazy business of professional wrestling?
Well, I actually started investigating this way back in 1982, when probably most of your listeners weren't even born yet. I was always involved with sports, whether in high school or at college, and I started working out and spent a lot of time in weight rooms, and so I developed a size that was actually, oh, okay, maybe I'm big enough to do this, because I always liked wrestling. So at the gym I belonged to, there was a sports agent, and he suggested, why don't I look into it? Now, he had no connections, but that put the idea in my head. And so the first person I came across was Larry Sharp. Now, Larry Sharp had the Monster Factory at the time. I mean, it probably wasn't even called the Monster Factory at that point. He had trained some people already. So he had trained King Kong Bundy, and one of the people at the school at that point, just breaking in, was Bam Bam Bigelow. So I had some discussions with Larry, and I lived in the Philadelphia area. So his training school was over in Jersey. So that was a little bit of a turnoff, because it was a hike. And I subsequently found a guy who was a bouncer at a bar closer to where I live in the Philadelphia area. And this guy, his name was the Concrete Cowboy, went by. And he did some work for Bruno Sammartino's group I forget what it was called. I'm not sure if it was called the IC. It may have been called the ICW. I think that's what it may have been called. And he did some work with them. And he was opening up a school, ironically, in an area really close by to where I lived. So he was cheaper. I didn't have any type of contractual requirements like I would have if I went with Larry. And so I went with him, and that's where I started. I was in a I learned in a stationary boxing ring. So that was really stiff, but he opened the doors for me, and then from there I sort of charted my own course. He didn't stay around that much longer, but I did, and now it's 40 years later, and I'm still doing it.
When you broke into professional wrestling, the territorial system was in place, which is much different than the independent system of today. Most territories allowed a wrestler to work full-time in the business if they chose. The independent system, usually you have to supplement your wrestling income in order to survive financially, usually on the independents. Shows will be weekly or sometimes monthly, sometimes even quarterly, whereas in the territorial days, you had 6 to 7 days of shows per territory. Do you think, having worked in both systems, one was superior over the other as far as learning the business and being able to survive in the business?
Well, Sarah, that's an interesting question because for me, the closest that I worked in a territory would have been with this group, the IWCCW up in New England. That was Mario Savaldi's group. But I've always had a regular full-time job, only because independent wrestling, territory wrestling, you're just not making the kind of money that I would need to survive. But then that held me back from probably getting a bigger break and working for one of the bigger organizations. Now, as far as the territories, those were a great place to be to learn your craft, because you are working 5-6 nights out of the week. Now, the type of money you're making was not great. If you were a fan favorite, you always had a chance to sell merchandise and be able to maybe get people to pick up a few meals for you. So you're really almost going, you're doing that with the hopes of getting picked up with one of the larger organizations. But that's where you get a lot of really good experience, working a territory, working every night, working a program with whatever associated TV you had. So, but for me, that really wasn't an option that I chose. Two reasons. One, the guy who trained me did not have those types of contacts. I subsequently met people that could have gotten me into a territory like Tennessee or Puerto Rico, maybe even the Pacific Northwest, but I always wanted to have the financial security of having a real profession that made where I made some good money.
Understood.
Right, but the indie world at the time when I broke in was just sort of getting started in the East Coast, because pretty much at that point in the East Coast you just had WWWF. That was it. And there was another group. It was called, I think it was called ICW, and I think that was Mario Sivoldi. I think Bruno had some involvement with it. And they ran some shows, not so much on, more out towards maybe Pittsburgh, maybe a few shows here and there on the East Coast. So when it happened for me, I started working for a lot of these like smaller promotions that started up. Now, it's nothing like the indie circuit is right now, because there are a ton of indie promotions, and they didn't draw like we drew. We would have 600,000-800,000 people at an indie show, which nowadays would be considered tremendous. But that was fairly routine back in the day. And I found myself wrestling quite often because there wasn't that many guys available. Back then, there were very few schools around. I think you had, of course, Larry Sharp. You had Dominic DiNucci training people out in the Pittsburgh area. We had another gentleman by the name of Mark Tendler who was training people up in New York. So there really wasn't a whole lot of talent out there. So I would find myself in New England one week. I would be in Maryland the next week. I would be out in Western Pennsylvania or Ohio. So I really got to get a chance to make a name for myself in the independents in the Northeast and in the Mid-Atlantic.
One of the things that most wrestlers had as far as goals, if they were on the independent circuit in the 80s and early 90s, was getting a look at the national companies on television. When you were getting started on the independents, the AWA and World Class still had ESPN shows. WWF, of course, was on USA Network. The NWA had a presence on TBS. So there were ways to get extra work with the companies and be on national television if you were an independent. Did you ever get many opportunities to do extra work for the larger companies?
Yes, I did. This would have been in the mid-80s. I did some work for the AWA. And so we were on ESPN. And I was pretty well liked there as almost a Johnny Rods type for that group. And what was great about that was I got to wrestle some really major talent. So I wrestled people like Sergeant Slaughter, Nick Bockwinkel, Rick Martel, Bob Backlund. And so, and the matches were competitive. So Vern Gagne actually took a liking to me, and I was hoping that might have opened a door, but it turned out that they stopped doing TV in the Atlantic City area. They moved it out to Las Vegas, and then after that, pretty much the operation shut down. So that was the closest that I had in terms of getting a big break. But that was good though, because it opened up even more doors for me on the indie circuit, because I started getting booked with some of the name guys as main events on the indie shows, people that I worked with on AWA. So I find myself headlining a lot of cards with Sergeant Slaughter on some of these indie shows, and these indie shows drew really well. And so that's how that worked out. Now, the world class merged with this ICW group that I worked for up in New England. And they were actually syndicated in different parts of the country on some of the smaller cable networks. But it went all over the country. So I would go into a town, say, in Virginia, on an indie card, but people would recognize me from the TV exposure I had there. So that actually worked out really well. And again, they brought up the up there. They did bring in some talent too, from Puerto Rico and from down south. So that was also a way to, I think, broaden my experience. So the ESPN coverage, I think, really helped get me more additional bookings on the indie circuit.
You and I shared a locker room for the first time at a promotion that is near and dear to me, that being Gouge Pro Wrestling in Raleigh, North Carolina. I know you have worked there a few times. How did you first get involved with Gouge?
Oh, geez. I don't even remember that organization. I think that was with Count Grog, perhaps. So that was my in with them. So they were doing a memorial show for Big Slam, and I was pretty good friends with him. So I came down there for them and worked that card. I love working down in the I love working down south because the fans are more spirited there. And they do sort of appreciate an old-school wrestling type type card, which I fit in well with. I'm not a deathmatch sort of guy, so I like working down south because I think the crowds are a little bit more spirited.
One of the other things that you are noted for is you were around when ECW was very first forming in Philadelphia and becoming a promotion. What was it like at that time wrestling in what would later become one of the national companies?
Well, yeah, I was there at the beginning when Todd Gordon was the promoter. And a guy by the name of Larry Winters and I think A.J. Petrucci were doing the booking then. And so they were using a lot of local Philly guys. And the Philly audience really was more of a hardcore audience. And that's really where a lot of the hardcore started to really come about, even before Eddie Gilbert got there, and then when Paul Heyman got there, then it really got to the point where it became, you know, really hardcore and like R-rated wrestling as opposed to the more family-oriented wrestling. So I sort of pulled out before Eddie Gilbert got there. It just wasn't necessarily, you know, my cup of tea, and I was getting bookings elsewhere, and so I didn't think that my particular style and presentation really fit in well. In retrospect, I would probably have been somebody who could have been used as the anti-hardcore guy, but yeah, that it was interesting at that time because that's where, like, I think a lot of the indies really started to multiply at that point because of the proliferation of all these different wrestling schools. Once the wrestling schools started popping up, more and more guys were out there, and it made it a little bit harder to get bookings too. But that was my I was out of the ECW right before I think Eddie Gilbert got there. And another thing with the ECW is that they really didn't have they were running the ECW arena, but really didn't have a whole lot of house shows, which is what I was most interested in, is getting booked on those house shows. But I was able to still keep myself busy without relying on them.
You also appeared on MTV in the early 2000s as one of their reality wrestling shows that they aired that era. What can you tell us about how you got to be on MTV?
that was interesting. I'm really good friends with Tom Brandy, and who works with Sal Sincere, but he was Tom Brandy at the time. And actually, Tony Atlas booked us, and they were coincidentally doing a MTV special where they followed three wrestlers around. One was a brand new guy. The other was Triple H, and so meaning somebody who was current, and then someone who was older, which was Tony Atlas. So Tony Atlas booked us for three shows up in New England, and the first show came off, the second show didn't, and there was a discrepancy with money, and it turned out to be pretty funny. We got our money, and then we came home. We were booked for 3 days. We only wrestled once, and we got paid for the other 2 days. And it's like, well, okay, I guess we're done. But that was for a short-lived promotion up there. I used to love wrestling up in Maine. We did a lot up in New England with this ICW group. We were on regular TV up there, and it was just coincidental that they were doing footage for the MTV special. We didn't know anything about it. And then all of a sudden, when we were there, they did some interviews with us about what happened. And all of a sudden, it turned out that was on, I think, Real Life or whatever it's called. But, yeah, it was a wrestling documentary. We had no plan to be on it.
Speaking of Maine, one of the more well-known wrestling personalities out of Maine is former WCW announcer Chris Cruz. And in the last couple of years on social media, he's become sort of a controversial figure. He turned AEW into the State Athletic Commission in Maryland. He has regularly decried several older veteran wrestlers still wrestling, calling for them to retire. He's been sort of a controversial figure online, if you will. Do you have any thoughts on how Chris Cruz is presenting himself on social media?
Well, I've actually been I've been in his crosshairs as well. So I know his whole thing. I don't get it. Now, what he's doing with some of the things that he's done, he's going to really he's really raised the ire of a lot of people. I know he's not a big fan. And he continually attacks George South, Tommy Rich, Ricky Morton. And, you know, I was on cards with Tommy. Tommy's a great guy. I work with Ricky. Ricky's a great guy. And I just don't know how – I mean, he – I don't associate him with being around wrestling all that long, and to have that type of an authority to be able to take shots at these guys. George South, I don't know, but you know, I'm in that same boat. Age-wise, I'm probably about as close to those guys. I've been around. I've been around not as long as Ricky or Tommy, but just maybe a little bit longer than George. And there really isn't a need for that. When you go to a wrestling match, especially in an indie card, it's good to see the variety. Now, I tell people that in my matches, because they're really old-school matches, I'm like a novelty, right? But it's that variety that makes the wrestling a little bit more interesting. So people are going to boo me. They're going to chant. I'm going to get the crowd riled up. I'm not going to do all the flippy stuff, but I look like an old-school wrestler because I am an old-school wrestler. So I think he's really off base, and I know he has a handful of followings. I do like laughing at his bad indie posters, but he's not making many friends in the wrestling world, especially trying to turn going to the State Athletic Commission about people and blocking them from making money. That's not a real smart thing to do, but some of the folks in this business. So, like I said, I don't know what he gets out of it, but I guess to each his own.
On the flip side of that, one of the organizations that tries to help benefit professional wrestling and keep the history alive and really celebrate all of the legends of our industry is the Cauliflower Alley Club. They have the annual meeting every year where people from within the business come together. They run seminars. They have cribbage tournaments. There's live wrestling shows attached to it now. They do a lot of good with their benevolent foundation to help wrestlers in financial need for whatever reason. What do you think of the CAC?
Oh, if I was able to, I would go to that. I would go to Las Vegas every year. I've only been to one because of my schedule. But I loved going there, and a lot of my friends are there. People who I've met, people who I've worked with, and haven't seen for years. I remember running into Scott Hall there, and I said, "Scott, I wrestled you when you first started." I said, "Oh, you were a handful," and I saw another guy who. Wasn't a big time wrestler, but he was on shows that I was on in Jersey City back in like 1983, and I'm walking through and I'm like, wait, I know you, and so it was great, but also to meet some of the other again the older guys. That's what I sort of enjoy because I sort of really don't follow wrestling now unless I'm involved. But if I get a chance, last time I was out there, I was working out, and who came in but the Adrian Street, and he's one of the funniest, like wittiest guys that I've ever met in wrestling. And I was up with him in Maine. He was up there for one or two tours. He's a funny guy, and so meeting some of those types of people that are real legends in the business, that was worthwhile. I did go out there and I wrestled. They had a battle royal, so I packed some gear and I said, okay, I'll go in it and play around. But but now I'm getting to the point where some of these other guys who, you know, some of them have made it, made names for themselves, but I wrestled them when they were first starting. And so it's sort of neat to catch up with them to be able to, you know, and they invariably say, hey, I learned a lot from you working with you back in the day. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. But yeah, I really think it's a great organization. I was hoping that they would move it back to April, but I think this year it was in September, and I think that they may have moved that, I think, to September's now, where the big event in Las Vegas is. It used to be in April, which worked out better for me schedule-wise. But I think now it's maybe late August when they have it this year. And I'd really like to try and get out there because it was a great 4 days.
One of the things in professional wrestling that everyone has to deal with at some point is blood in wrestling, whether it's planned or not. A lot of states have regulations on the books when it comes to what you have to do if blood is introduced during a match. I know you've been around enough to have seen plenty of blood in your career, whether it was by accident or not, if it was your own or an opponent's. A lot of people have opinions on it just because of what medical science has taught us over the last few years with bloodborne pathogens. Do you have an opinion on blood within pro wrestling as it sits in 2024?
I don't really think it's necessary, but when people have these death matches, those are hardcore death matches, you almost expect that to happen. And for me, that's not the type of show that I'm going to get booked on. So on a regular, say, a regular show that somebody's trying to book and it's going to be, quote, family friendly, I really don't think there's a place for it or a need for it. Now, again, if you're catering to a hardcore audience, it's expected. And so I just don't, I mean, without getting involved with those types of shows, or the shows that I'm on, there's not a need for it. So, and again, with the potential health risks, you do want to be careful. So, if it's not needed for anything, I would just leave it alone. If you're going to be in a hardcore death match, you have more things to worry about getting hurt than bloodborne pathogens. So, for me, it's just not part of my repertoire, and I don't particularly care for it.
Another thing that a lot of wrestlers have experienced, especially in the time frame where you were breaking in, are the scary fan incidents where fans go over a line when they don't like something in the ring, whether they attack a wrestler or throw something or whatever the case may be. A lot of us have experienced some pretty scary fan moments. What would you say has been your scariest fan moment?
Well, I like to tell people that I've had more different, such a wide variety of things thrown at me over the years. So let me list some of them. I wrestled in a bullfighting stadium in Ecuador, and they were throwing oranges. And this was at a bullfighting stadium, but about 7,500 people. And these oranges were coming at me from all over the place. And if you get hit with an orange in the head, you're going to get hurt. So that was interesting. I wrestled in Italy, Another big crowd, about maybe 13,000 people. They were throwing coins. They were throwing lira. So, funny thing with that is after the match and after they cleared the arena, I went around the outside of the ring and collected a whole bunch of coins. I don't know what they were worth, but it was like, okay, if I'm going to get hit with these things, that's all right. So I also had one of the more interesting things I got hit with were cork test tube stoppers. It was a show at a high school out in Long Island, and they must have broke into the biology class, and they were throwing these cork test tube stoppers. I remember getting hit with those. One of the ones that maybe concerned me the most was I was wrestling Virgil, the Ted DiBiase's guy. He became a fan favorite, and I was wrestling him at a Labor Day show in the Reading, Pennsylvania, and it was at a baseball stadium, and it was packed, and it was all union people, a bunch of Teamsters, and so I cut a really tough promo before the show about not needing unions, and it takes seven people to hammer one nail into a board. And so the ring was set up in the infield, and I had Virgil covered, and then I felt someone pull my leg, and somebody pulled me off of Virgil. It was a guy that came out of the stands onto the field. And I'm like, hey, what's going on here? And that's the only place where I asked for a police escort out of the arena. So that was probably my most concerning experience. But dodging the oranges was also up there in terms of danger. Now I could feel. Jersey City show. As I was going through the crowd, I remember something sharp hitting me in the back. So I'm not sure if it was a knife or if it was something else, but that was early on in my career. So I didn't know what to expect then. So at the time, I was like a little concerned. But the crowds are much more tame now. So I don't have to worry too much. I mean, I still am a person who gets a lot of heat from the audience, but the people are much more well controlled now.
We have a game that we like to play on the show. We call it Word Association. I will throw out the names of some people that you most likely have come in contact with over the course of your career, and the first word or two that comes to mind is the answer. Are you prepared for some word association?
Yeah, sure.
All right, here we go. First name, Tom Brandy.
Tom Brandy. He's my best friend.
Boris Zukov.
Boris Zukov. Big head.
Count Grog.
Count Grog. Needs to lose the beard.
Shane Taylor.
Shane Taylor. Is that... is that... Who's Shane Taylor?
He's with Ring of Honor. Great big power guy.
I don't know him.
Okay, no worries. Casey Carlisle.
I met her way back when... Nice girl.
Tony Atlas.
Tony Atlas. Word association. Had a great match with him.
JT Smith.
Where is he? Miss him.
Seymour Snott.
Not familiar with that guy.
Marty Jannetty.
Marty Jannetty. Wish I could have wrestled him.
Jim Brunzell.
Great dropkick.
Vic Steamboat.
Vic or Rick?
Vic.
Vic, great opponent.
Iron Sheik.
The absolute funniest man in professional wrestling.
Dory Funk Jr.
Great ambassador to the sport. I learned from him.
Sergeant Slaughter.
Oh, best, maybe one of the best gimmicks ever.
Final name, Gary Michael Capetta.
Oh, consummate professional. Maybe the best.
All right, that wraps up Word Association.
I'm glad I knew most of the folks there.
Yep. Always helps if we pick familiar names. One of the things in pro wrestling that has become sort of a big story in the last couple of months is the motion picture, The Iron Claw. It, of course, chronicles the lives and the careers of the Von Erich family. And in the last few weeks since it's released, a lot of fans have had mixed emotions about the film, some upset that it was not 100% historically accurate. Other people thought it was very, very good as a motion picture based on a real story. Others thought it was not as good as what it could have been based on the real story. Have you seen the film and formed an opinion on it?
You know, I'm not a movie guy, but I was out, as a matter of fact, with Tom Brandy, and he went out to see it. And we were both laughing at one spot in the movie that he had mentioned. And it was about Kevin's inability to do a promo. And he said that was so spot on that it's almost like it was almost like an inside joke, because he did a couple tours with us up in New England, and he had to cut a promo, and it must have took him about 15 minutes 20 minutes to cut a promo because he kept on messing it up. So that part's true. But without having seen the movie, I guess the closer you were to the history of that family, maybe you got the feeling that no, it wasn't really true to life. But people who aren't familiar with the Von Erichs, which a lot of people aren't, they probably thought, oh, but this is a nice story. But that, to me, if I go to see that movie, that's the part I'm going to laugh about most, is him trying to cut a promo. And I actually did get to wrestle him up there on one of the shows, and in fact, one of the a friend of mine on Facebook had just sent me the video of that match. And oddly enough, where we were at, Kevin tried to get into the ring, and he sort of missed there was a gap between the stage where we were on and the ring, and he actually fell before getting into the ring, and he cut himself. he hit his head. So there was blood in that match. So that was interesting. I almost wish that was in the movie. Then I would go see it.
I was going to ask if you had
wrestle with Kevin when the ICW and World Class merger went. Now, just being around Kevin Von Erich at shows in that time frame, this was in an era where he admittedly had a lot of substance issue problems and was not in the best of state. I know he actually collapsed in a match and his opponent had to perform CPR at one point in that time frame. Did you get a sense from being on shows with him that something wasn't right with him, or did you not know enough about him to know that maybe there was a problem?
I just didn't know that he was that bad off in terms of the drugs. I just don't know if he was just, you know, a guy that was sort of out there, or if it was because of the drugs. I never understood why he wrestled barefoot myself. I just thought that, you know, a lot of guys were on drugs back then. So it wasn't, maybe this is the way the guy came. You know, maybe he, maybe he had some concussions somewhere along the line. Just said, okay, this guy can't cut a promo. that's what I left with.
Now, in that time period as well, when professional wrestling was still sort of in the boom era and the scandals hadn't hit the national companies yet, there was still a lot of pro wrestling on television. And here in 2024, we're seeing almost the same amount, if not more, wrestling on TV with the national groups. Several independent groups have television. A lot of companies now have streaming services that isn't quite the same, but very, very similar in concept to running television. When you were wrestling, were you wrestling the same on television, the same way you would wrestle at a show without any TV cameras, or did you have to adapt depending on which show it was?
I would say, I mean, obviously when you're doing TV, if you are working with a match with a newcomer, then it's going to be a shorter match, right? But if you are one of the marquee matches on that TV show, then that's going to be longer. So, but for the most part, when you're doing TV, you're really sort of like telling a story, the storyline for the for who they're building up, you know, who are the top guys coming in, things like that. But when you're working on house shows, it's different, you know. So there was a difference in terms of how you would how the matches were. Nowadays. At least on the independent shows, if they're streaming them, they're pretty much the same thing. You don't have the squash matches like you would have with WCW and WWE. Like back in the day, you would have your experienced guys just beating up on the new guys, and you're waiting for like that one marquee match, but now they're trying to make all the matches marquee, and so the product is different.
One of the big things that was in wrestling, probably in various time frames, is the heavy use of steroids in wrestling. Of course, the WWF was caught in the big steroid scandal of the 90s where Vince McMahon had to go to federal court. We know that lots of wrestlers at different time frames were using anabolic steroids to try to get bigger so they could get contracts with the national companies. Wrestling is, of course, a very visual business where you want to look the part. It doesn't seem to be as important now, so hopefully the steroids are not as prevalent. But from what you have seen throughout your entire career, do you think that the steroid problems have either come to an end or have slowed way down, or do you think they're still out there but just not talked about as much right now?
Well, it's definitely slowed down. 'Cause when I would say in the '80s and even in the '90s, it was really big. That's one of my claims to fame, is that I've never taken any of those types of enhancements, whether it be anabolic steroids or HGH. That's always been one of the things that I prided myself on, is I've never taken them. And my character was one that didn't really require that. You know, I spend six days a week in the gym even now. And so I like the natural look. I'm built like an old school wrestler, barrel chested. I'm not cut up like a bodybuilder. I really found that some of the guys who were on the steroids, who were the bodybuilder types, really weren't good wrestling wise. But with McMahon promoting the product that he was, people needed to have that size. That's what people wanted. Now, you still have guys that are obviously on them, but it's not many. But, you know, when Vince wants to, Vince or AEW has somebody who's a big, you know, giant size guy, well, the guy's obviously going to be on the steroids. Now, on the indie side, it's almost in the opposite direction. There are a lot of guys that are wrestlers or booked as wrestlers, and some of them have some nice techniques. They're good high flyers, but they're under 200 pounds or under 180 pounds. And it's not part of the visual aspect, like you mentioned before. It's sort of taken away because these guys aren't big, and some of them aren't even in a gym that much. So, and for me, that's great, because on an indie card, I'm quite seasoned, but sometimes one of the best built guys on the card. But there's definitely overall, I think there's more of a the guys themselves. They're you don't have people who are totally jacked up like they were back in the day, and I think that's good overall, because you don't want guys to. There's a lot of guys that have died early that know were abusing the steroids. And it's really sad to see them go because of that.
As someone that has been around for quite a while, obviously you have traveled a lot, put in countless miles. For people that are new to the wrestling business or looking to get into the wrestling business, do you have any travel tips that would help a wrestler make his road trips more successful?
Well, that's a good question. It was funny. One of the guys that I was mentor for when he first started was Steve Corino. And one of the things I told Steve back in the day, the first thing you got to do is learn how to read a map. This is before GPS. Right, because that's, I mean, because we would go to, when you're an indie, a guy who's really getting booked in different spots, you got to learn how to, you had to learn how to read a map, because we would go up to Maine, we would go out to Ohio, we would go down to North Carolina, Virginia, and so you had to know how to go around. But I was always one of the guys that, that a lot of the guys looked up to, because I actually made money on the indies. And that's because I knew how to cut corners, I knew how to save money, I knew how to travel. So one of the things that the young guys really need to do is get a fuel-efficient car that's dependable, and also you want to travel with guys. So if you can meet up with guys, even if they're not close to where you're at, if they're on the route, meet up with the guys. Go together, right? If you have to get a room, you split a room. I remember up in Maine, we had 7 guys in a room once. It was 5 guys and 2 midgets. We were going to make the midgets sleep in the drawers, right? But we were able to cut corners that way. So you definitely want to travel with somebody when you're a new guy and you're not making big money. Mm-hmm. You also want to try, if you have merchandise, you want to try and do merchandise. It's tough now. It's tough now because there's so many guys that are out there. And I know promoters are paying guys, maybe enough to get gas. So you have to be able to pull resources together. I think that's probably the biggest thing in terms of traveling. If you have to get a hotel room, if the promoter's picking it up, all right, you're fine. But if not, you need to put as many people as you can in that hotel room, and you have to pull the mattress off and sleep on the box spring. Somebody else sleeps on the mattress. Well, that's what you got to do.
Well, we're down to the final minutes of today's show, King Kalua, and I want to make sure that there's ample time for you if you would like to say anything to the listeners in closing, and if you want to plug absolutely anything and everything from social media to appearances, merchandise, your favorite steakhouse, anything at all, floor is all yours.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, I am working on getting a merchandise site, but if anyone's interested in any King Kalua merchandise, just friend me on Facebook at Michael Kalua. I got some shows coming up. I'm going to be in Lewistown, Pennsylvania in February. I'm going to be in the Allentown area, Allentown, Pennsylvania. In March, I'm also going to be in Gloucester, New Jersey, and I have a couple other dates that are coming up as well in the near future. I generally will post them on my Facebook, so I'd love to see people come out and boo me on. But I'd just like to thank you for having me booked on this, presentation here. It's nice to be able to have people appreciate people who are experienced and can tell you stories from back in the day. So thanks for the opportunity.
Our pleasure to have you here, and hopefully it won't be the last time that we have you here, and hopefully our paths will cross again. Time.
I hope so. Hopefully I can get down to North Carolina at some point during this year. But you never know where I'm going to show up. So I pop up at places you wouldn't even think.
Even Alaska.
Maybe even Alaska, right? If they want an old guy up there with old school experience, absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We definitely appreciate you. Fans, if you are not familiar with King Kalua,
make sure you remedy that. Fantastic talent. There's a lot out there on YouTube and other sources to learn more. Go see a show if he is on it. You can find what he does out there. You can find us on the airwaves right back here on Sunday afternoon, coming up this Sunday at a very special time, 6 Pacific, 9 Eastern. We have the Drip Goat, Cosmo Williams, with us. And 1 week from today, we have Texas-based independent wrestling star Reggie Lincoln back on the program. So make sure you have plans to join us. Everybody stay safe out there. Get out there, support your local independents if you have some near you. And we will talk to you soon.